On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk hard-to-define 80s films with Buckaroo Banzai and The Golden Child.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast. In a place where everyone has an opinion. Two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And thanks for joining another episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And today on this another social distancing episode of Video Culture, these are the two most random movies I think we could have ever picked to go together.
You know, as you say that, but I think when we get into it, there's and this may come up in your trivia, but there's some DNA that these movies share.
I know there's some actors that cross between a couple of different movies and things like that, but Buckaroo Banzai and The Golden Child. Now, a lot of people, Buckaroo Banzai, which is the full title, is The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. And this was a movie in 1984. And this is one of those movies that you either know about or you know nothing about. Because you cannot mistake this movie like, yeah, maybe I think I saw that. No.
Yeah.
This movie is just so out there. It's almost like a spectacle, and you're like, "What the heck is going on?"
Yeah, the way I look at it, you either don't know what you either have never seen Buckaroo Banzai, or you really like or love Buckaroo Banzai.
Like, right.
I don't think I've ever seen. I don't think I've ever shown it to anyone who was like, "I hated it." They're usually like, "What the hell was that?" But I think I liked it.
Yeah, I'm probably in that second category. Because it was like, you know, it's one of those that you watch and you're even in the middle of it, you're like, what am I watching? So, and it has a huge amount of stars, in the cast of this movie, Peter Weller, John Lithgow, Ellen Barkin, Jeff Goldblum, Christopher Lloyd, and a couple other people that have been like, you know, in other movies, Clancy Brown,
who we just talked about in Highlander like 2 weeks ago, a month ago at this point, yeah,
the guy, what's the guy's name that Saul, the Better Call Saul guy,
Jonathan Banks is in it, character actor Dan Hedaya is in it, who's in tons of things,
Yakov Smirnoff.
Yeah, he's in it.
as a weird, like, cameo, almost.
Yeah, the movie is just chocked full of familiar faces.
A lot of character actors that you've seen in, like, other movies, but just, like, totally and completely strange adventure, like, kind of sci-fi film.
Okay. And so I'll go ahead and quickly try to sum it up. I know we normally read, like, an IMDb synopsis. Yeah. But I'm going to try to like give you the dime store idea of what Buckaroo Banzai is.
You go for it.
Okay. Buckaroo Banzai is basically a rock star scientist brain surgeon who, along with his buddies and his band, the Hong Kong Cavaliers, basically solve crimes and help the general public and are basically celebrities in this 80s fantasy world. And in the film, they basically discover aliens who came to Earth years ago, who have been living among us, and they get into a confrontation with them. That's basically it. But what's wild about Buckaroo Banzai is none of this stuff is clearly laid out in the beginning.
No.
It's kind of just, you kind of give him pieces of it as you go along. It's like The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension is Buckaroo Banzai Part 3. Okay. But we never got Parts 1 and 2.
Exactly. You kind of get the idea, I mean, it kind of starts off like in the past, just like this weird flashback where Buckaroo Banzai's dad is setting up this weird experiment, you know, in like the 40s in the desert with this like jet car, and they're trying, he's, you know, there's like a narrator, and it goes over like, you know, Dr. Banzai has created this, what was it called? Like
something injector. I can't remember the first word of it, but something injector.
Yeah. I'm failing me. I could look, but anyway, that you could pass through physical matter, right? Like,
yes.
You had to go fast enough. You had to like this oscillator thing or whatever, what it was called. So, but then after that, the experiment goes bad and you don't know what happens, but then it was revealed sort of like what later kind of like some of the bad things that happen. I mean, it's just way out there. I mean, it's just, we can't explain it all because it would take like 4 hours to explain the movie, yeah, and it would take somebody like 2 hours to watch it.
Yeah, because basically it just kind of drops you in the world and expects you to keep up. Yeah. And
but like the important thing to remember, though, that Peter Weller is Dr. Buckaroo Banzai, who's like the son of this other scientist, but we get the idea that he's this like genius madman, you know, like he's you know, he's a comic book character who's like really awesome. He's this kind of, has kind of like rock star fame. He's also this famous scientist, famous doctor, like famous everything. Like
literally, you kind of get the impression he's the world's biggest celebrity.
Right.
Like everyone knows Buckaroo Banzai. He's got a fan club. He's got all these different things going on. I mean, again, he's a rock star. He's a scientist. He's a doctor. And they also make comic books about him. So he's obviously going on adventures and fighting bad guys.
Right. So it's kind of like he's, you know, a rock star, like, you know, Justin Timberlake combined with like Neil deGrasse Tyson combined with like, you know, another
Indiana Jones
and Elon Musk, and like that's what you kind of get out of it.
Yeah, he's basically kind of everything, and right. And Weller, who was is mostly known for RoboCop, plays Buckaroo as kind of this like really kind of down to earth but coolly detached sort of guy. Like he's not really smug. He's kind of low key and charming,
mm-hmm.
but you don't ever get the idea that he's ever really full of himself. Even though he's supposedly so famous and popular, he's just very kind of down to earth. Wants to hang out with his buddies who play in his band, who are also like his science bros. You know, he just wants to make the world a better place.
Yeah, I mean, he is a rock star. He's in that. He's in his own band, and
yeah,
they have their own. I mean, he has his own, you know, comic books that everybody. I mean, it's just, you know, he's an icon. You know what I mean? He's a franchise in himself. You know, and also like the super scientist, which is just weird.
Yeah, he's basically everything, and his band is basically made up of this cavalcade of like of almost over the top cartoonish characters who are kind of designated with code names based on where they're from. You know, like right. You've got this cowboy character who's played by Clancy Brown from Highlander. You've got this other guy who's like from like Brooklyn, and they're all kind of
Clancy, you know, Brown. Yeah, he plays Rawhide.
Yeah, Rawhide, and they're all kind of like. They're all kind of caricatures in themselves. Like,
Lewis, okay, so I do have to mention there is a character in the movie. This character's name in the movie is called Perfect Tommy, and he's just like well, sort of like clean cut guy. He kind of looks like a more modern, like James Dean looking dude. And I first looked at him and I was like, is James Franco in this movie?
Is he a time traveler?
Holy crap! That's James Franco, and I'm like. Yeah. You start looking at me like, no, he's not James Franco. Is he like James Franco's dad or his uncle or something? He looks just like him. Like, literally, they're almost like body doubles. Like, that guy looks exactly, they look the same.
He's got a lot of qualities that are similar, yeah, but that would make Franco very, very old if that was the case.
That's exactly right, because I just look up, it's like, 1984? No, James Franco would have been like, you know, 10. It's like, be weird.
But in Perfect Tommy is sort of like Buckaroo's Robin to his Batman. Like, he's sort of Buckaroo's second in command.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. So he's in the movie a lot, so you're just like,
yeah,
you know, whoa. I mean, but also Lewis Smith was in other movies. He was in like Wyatt Earp and Django Unchained, actually.
He was, yeah. He's had a pretty good career. And I guess the Willard's got a lot of really cool quotable lines in this movie. And one of the ones that I always love.
There is a lot of quotable movies because there's a lot of like, I don't know, like sort of absurd, what I call absurd moments. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
Where it's just like kind of like where it ventures into comedy land, where it almost kind of parodies itself, not really like in kind of Airplane territory, but it's almost like where it just gets, you know, really sarcastically funny.
It becomes absurd, but
yeah.
But the thing about it is, and why it works is that every character in the movie plays it straight, and absurd stuff only works when everyone plays it straight, as if it's not absurd. And I gotta say,
over the top, because you know, John Lithgow, who plays like this crazed, you know, that's one of the bad experiments, is like he was on, kind of goes crazy because he, you know, was kind of one of the first to try to go through, you know, this other dimension or go through this physical space, and goes crazy and he kind of becomes possessed. To get back to that dimension or whatever, and he plays this mad scientist guy, and he's just like really super over the top, but he never breaks down. It's just like the same throughout the whole thing, no matter how ridiculous that it is, and no matter how ridiculous that like Rawhide is dressed up like a cowboy everywhere he goes, you know what I mean? It's just, yeah, that's just part of it. And I think like Goldblum, like even though he wasn't in many scenes, he's also like a brain surgeon, and he's like wearing like, you know, his white jacket everywhere, you know.
No, like Goldblum is dressed like he should be in a Primus video the entire time. Like, like he's got this ridiculous like red cowboy shirt on and these ridiculous mm-hmm. like cowboy pants, you know. Mm-hmm. it's really absurd. Yeah. And outside of Lithgow, everyone else plays it very normal. So when Lithgow is, you know, overacting, everyone else reacts to him very normally. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what makes it work.
I mean, even Christopher Lloyd, you know, who we all know, and I had to look up, like, this was the movie that Chris Lloyd did, like, right after Back to the Future. It's like he did Back to the Future and then, like, went... Or maybe it was the opposite. He did this one and
yeah, it would have been right before Back to the Future.
Yeah, it's like he did this movie, and then he did Back to the Future, and he's also playing this ridiculous alien, you know, who looks like a bug basically, and his name is John Big Booty.
Well, I mean,
I know it's John Big Bootay, which we don't find out to the end, but it's still.
Yeah,
like...
but that's one of the gags of the movie is when the aliens come to Earth, they all assume names that they think are Earth normal names, and they just all have the first name of John because they're not very creative, but then their last names are all ridiculous. Like one of them is named John Smallberries, and then you have John Big Booty and things like that, and it's those little things, and even the other characters who are seeing this are like, these names have to be a joke. That's kind of how they figure out that they're phony in the first place. So, like, this guy's last name is Smallberries? What?
Yeah. Just absolutely ridiculous. It's that's the kind of the stuff and that they're dealing with. But it takes about 30 minutes into the movie before you really find out, like, what is actually going on? Where is this movie going? And what are we doing about it? You know what I mean? And it's really, like you say, like it's almost like we're in episode 3. Like, you know, it took like 30 minutes to kind of establish who Dr. Buckaroo Banzai was and like the experiment to kind of like set up everything else. So there's, it's the longest like setup I've ever seen in any movie.
Yeah, I think it works for me. It works because I like those characters. I like hanging out with them. I like seeing them in their band. You know, I like those little moments, like when they're playing music, or when Buckaroo's talking to the crowd and before they play. You know, he's got that great line about, "Hey, don't be mean."
Yeah, and I think you know, it didn't really take off in theaters, and it really kind of took off as a cult thing. And I think the more times you watch it, the more like you actually know where the story's going. I think you can appreciate all those things a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Well, so it's like, it's kind of fun and it's kind of cool. And you're just like, oh, that's kind of cool. Wait a second. I got to watch that movie again. Like, this was just too messed up. And then you watch it again and you watch it with your friends. And then, you know, pretty soon you're like quoting the movie. And yeah, it's, well, you know, it becomes really funny.
I can't imagine how you would have really marketed this when it was coming out. How would you explain this to somebody in a way that's quick and snappy and makes them want to go see it?
Well, I have a little bit about that in my notes, but basically it was the marketing they used was just marketing Buckaroo Banzai is kind of like this, you know, more than awesome Indiana Jones, like you said. But like more sci-fi, you know, really awesome kind of guy. So,
it's almost, for the very beginning, you're like, oh, I get why this movie was not successful when it came out. Because it's really kind of a movie you have to be patient with. You have to kind of let it sit with you for a while after you've seen it to really get why it's so much fun.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, because there's not a whole lot of, you know, just like, slapstick humor or any of that. There's a lot of heady stuff to kind of figure out, like, what is exactly happening and why is this actually funny, to know where the relationships are and to know where kind of things are going. So I think that's part of it too.
Yeah, there's lots of little subtle things to it. I mean, like, I go back to a lot of Peter Weller's lines as Buckaroo. Like, at one point, whenever he asked, you know, Perfect Tommy to do something, and Tommy's like, "Why me?" And he goes, "Well, Tommy, because you're perfect." And then Tommy just kind of begrudgingly accepts that and does whatever he asks him to do.
Right.
Little things like that. And, I mean, I find the movie so much fun to hang out with these characters, and it's fun to kind of see, like, Goldblum in a way is like the new member of the group. So he's kind of fanboying out about everything. It's fun to watch Goldblum be excited to be part of this band, and want so badly to impress Banzai. Just these little things that make it work, and just the oddity of the aliens. Like the aliens are really kind of silly, and it's fun to watch them, you know, just act like what they think human beings should be, but they're a little too stiff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun to watch them try to approximate human behavior and fail. There's lots of little things like that I really enjoy about the movie, and there's like little gags, like sometimes when the aliens will rhyme what they're saying, and if like they talk about how And poor John Stead, he fell down and broke his head, you know. And they're trying to say it like it's a sad thing.
Yes.
But I'm like, but they don't get that it rhymes, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I probably got the name of the character wrong, but that was the rhyme.
Little gags like that. I mean, I equate it to a lot, you know, kind of stuff in, kind of like in modern times, like Guardians of the Galaxy, you know what I mean? Like how all the aliens are weird and how, like, how weird Drax is, and I hate to relate like one movie to another movie, but you know, like, you know, he doesn't get why, you know, certain things are a certain way. Like, why would I put my finger across another man's throat or something like that? Like, they don't get any of those like human, you know, sort of things that we all know. And it's a very similar kind of humor, them trying to approximate, like you say, it's, I loved a lot of the gags, I mean, like you said, like with Christopher Lloyd, was absolutely like entertaining. Like every scene that he's in, you can just tell why he became, you know, like a star, because, you know, he came from like Taxi and stuff like that. And He was just breaking down into movies and doing like weird, you know, stuff like this. And, but yeah, I mean, he is certainly super entertaining. Like the scene between, Christopher Lloyd and John Lithgow. I mean, the play off of that they have off each other and like the scenes they have together are hysterical.
Yeah, it's because Lithgow's character basically belittles and doesn't respect Christopher Lloyd's character, and it just makes Christopher Lloyd's character so mad the entire time.
Yeah, because Chris Lloyd is kind of like John Big Booty. He's kind of like the leader of the group, and then when Dr. Emilio Lizardo, when he shows up, you know, he all of a sudden, like, he's like, wait a second, you know what I mean? So... Yeah,
he takes over with like this chaotic energy, and you know, before he showed up, the aliens are doing pretty well for themselves, you know, and his kind of chaoticness kind of wrecks everything,
right?
And so that tension between those two and those very silly characters is a lot of fun to watch, and I find the whole thing just so much fun. Like, I mean, every time I watch it, I discover new little things about it. Like, there's one little gag that I completely missed the last few times I watched it. Was at the end when Buckaroo and one of the aliens are flying a spaceship at the end, and Banzai has this moment where he's like, "Oh, this I know how to drive this now." And he hands it over to the alien. He goes, "It drives like a truck." And the alien's like, "Okay, what's a truck?"
Yeah.
And he says it real kind of quietly, and I had never noticed that before. I had seen it like four or five times.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
it's and him with that alien, you know, like you mentioned, like with the dreads, you know, with the dreadlocks and everything. Yeah, you know, so good. It's really kind of like weird, hard to follow, like when everything happens and you don't know what side to be on and who's on what side and who's doing what and who's the alien and who's not. Because one of the things about the movie, if you do watch it, is that the aliens look like humans, but apparently only Buckaroo Banzai, through another aliens, basically gets the power to see the aliens for who they are, and he gives that power to the rest of his crew, but yeah, they kind of walk amongst, you know, us, and yeah,
it's a little bit like a comedic They Live,
right,
you know, to reference another science fiction movie with a slightly similar concept.
Well, you just take my difficult explanations and you just break it down to something really simple. Hey,
that's why we're a team, brother. That's why we're a team.
That's right.
I've been trying to get you to watch this movie for a while because I know you love 80s films. You had never seen this. And to me, this is like the 80s geek movie because it is so unabashedly geeky.
Yeah.
So unabashedly 1980s, you know, I mean,
a lot of movies that we watched, like, kept going back to this movie. Like, we talked about Jeff Goldblum when we did Into the Night. Like, what other movies was he in the 80s that we don't know about? Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. You know, Peter Weller, I mean, he's done a lot of different stuff. What is being Buckaroo Banzai? You know, Christopher Lloyd, like, you know, we even talked about, you know, John Lithgow and Ellen Barkin. Ellen Barkin came up when we did the episode, the vampire movie.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, you're.
What is it? What by the name of the it escapes me. I'll get it here in a second.
Do you want to look at it for a second? I can always vamp for you.
Near Dark. Right, she was in Near Dark, right? Am I right?
I don't think that's right. Give me one second. I'm going to double check that.
She was in another movie.
Barely one second. Technical difficulties as we do a little research while the show is going on.
She was in Eddie and the Cruisers. I know. She was in Sea Love. What other movies did she do? Oh, she was in Tender Mercies. That's what it was. Yeah, she played the daughter. All of these like weird things kept coming up. And then it was also written and directed by W.D. Richter, who also co-wrote Big Trouble in Little China, which is one of your favorite films.
It is, yeah.
and which is also, you know, one of my favorite films too. It's that's another, like, you know, just fun adventure movie that you don't know where it's going. And
yeah, and it's another movie that doesn't hold your hand. It's another movie that just kind of drops you into everything, and they're like, hey, keep up.
Right. There's all this magic and mystery and mystical things, and you're just going to see a spectacle, and it's going to be fun. So it's kind of like a roller coaster that you don't know anything about. Like, and it starts off kind of like normal, and then just kind of goes in, you know, all these different directions.
Yeah, and also, like Beach Boy, Little China, it's incredibly hard to classify exactly what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the things where you're just like, oh man, I can't explain it, you just gotta watch it.
And, yeah. Is it an adventure? Is it a comedy? Is it a drama?
Is it horror film? It's a little bit of all those things.
Is it sci-fi? Like, what is it?
And Buckaroo Banzai is very much the same kind of thing. And I love the mythology of it all. I love the fact that you have to probably keep up with it. I like the idea that there's all these little hints at a much larger world in Buckaroo Banzai. Like they talk about his junior fan league. Like that, there's this one kid who basically saves him. Who ends up going on the adventure? He saves him halfway through the film. Ends up being on the adventure with him the rest of the time. And it's like this little 10-year-old boy who, at the end, that they arm him with like body armor and a machine gun. They're like, yeah, "Help us go fight the aliens, kid!" And him and his father are there fighting the aliens with him at the end. And you're like, "That's ridiculous, but it's kind of awesome,
right?" Yeah, I just sit there and think about, you know, as I watch the movie, like, why did all these people sign up to do this crazy movie? And the one thing that I kept thinking about is, you know, a lot of movies that they didn't know about that they, you know, thought were garbage or trash or like B movies were winding up being big hits like Star Wars and, you know, so like Indiana Jones. And it was kind of like, this looks crazy, but I'm going to do it, you know, and it's like, and then once you get a couple people, then the ball just starts rolling.
Yeah, then that's exactly it. Once you get one or two people to be like, "Yeah, I'm all for it," then other people are like, "Well, okay, he's in it. Okay, I'm in." You know, I actually interviewed Clancy Brown, about 3 years ago. Who, again, Clancy Brown plays Rawhide in this, and I actually asked about Buckaroo Banzai. I didn't make it into the final interview that got published, but I asked him what made him want to do it. And he actually said it was mainly because of the script. He said the script was so weird and unusual and so fun that he had to do it. I mean, like, how often do you get something like that? You're like, what is this? It sounds like so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he wanted to do it. Because he said it was so weird and different. It sounded like a fun experiment.
Yeah, it's not your normal, typical story by any means. It's super imaginative. So imaginative that I can't even think, like, you know what I mean? It's that kind of movie.
It throws a lot of ideas at you. It really does.
Yeah. Really quickly that you have to kind of hang on. And it's one of those things that I know people are probably, you know, not going to like it. Like, if my wife watched it, she would probably not like it. She might think a few scenes might be a little bit funny, but, you know, it's not going to be one of, you know, her favorite movies, but.
Yeah,
you know,
it's not a universal film by any means, and I don't mean the studio. I mean, when I say universal, I mean it's not something that everyone is going to like. But usually, the people who are clued into like really geeky things, are really enamored with it once they see it once or twice. Because, you know, because this film was one of the first movies to really inspire a very large and vocal fan community.
Yeah, well, like, I mean, it has a lot of characters that are. Very easily definable, kind of by their demeanor or by their costume. And I think that lends itself a lot to that as well. And just like the zaniness, of how zany, that the movie is. And I don't think that it's, a B movie by any, you know, stretch of the imagination, you know what I mean? But yeah, it's just one of those that's just really, really way out there. But super entertaining.
Yeah, it's hard to define. It's so singular, and I'm so happy it exists. I mean, to me, the world is better because this movie exists.
And there's not many other movies like it, to be quite honest.
No, not at all.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like anybody has tried to copy this formula whatsoever. So, if you're into, like, you know, comfort scripts. You know what I mean? It's
yeah. If you're looking for predictability, Buckaroo Banzai is not for you.
Certainly not it. Yeah.
But if you have a taste for the absurd and for the out there and for really rich backstory, then you know it's going to be your cup of tea for sure.
Right. Well, let's move on to The Golden Child. This was a movie in 1986. Most notably, it stars Eddie Murphy as the main sort of like child. This one, I'll go ahead and read the IMDb description because it's really short. Eddie Murphy plays a detective with a specialty of finding lost children. He is told he is the chosen one who will find and protect the Golden Child, a Buddhist mystic who was kidnapped by an evil sorcerer. Murphy disbelieves the mysticism, but finds more and more evidence of demon worship as he investigates. That was written by John Vogel on IMDb. Thank you very much. Besides Eddie Murphy, there's a couple other recognizable characters. Randall Tex Cobb, who is also like the bad guy in a couple other movies that you might have seen before. Like what was he in Raising Arizona? I think
he was in Raising Arizona. He was in a great little Rutger Hauer movie called Blind Fury. He's in a lot of things. Like literally he was everywhere in the 1980s.
Oh but yeah. And another movie he was in 1986 was he was in Fletch Lives.
Yes. Speaking of Fletch Lives, this was directed by the man who directed Fletch and Fletch Lives.
Yeah. It was directed by Michael Ritchie who directed Fletch Lives. He also directed like other weird movies like The Candidate, The Bad News Bears, The Scout, and it was produced by Edward S. Feldman, who also produced Near Dark, and also produced movies like The Explorers and The Truman Show. So,
yeah, kind of hard to define films much like this one. Yeah.
And I think, I mean, this was... I do know that this script kind of went through a few different changes before, you know, this movie came out. As a movie itself, we'll get to that in the notes, but, you know, as a movie, this one also is hard to define because it's mysticism. It does have Eddie Murphy kind of being an investigative kind of reporter or whatever, or an investigative person.
He's a private eye, basically.
Private eye, yeah. He's not like a cop or anything. But it's still kind of Eddie Murphy doing his, you know, kind of Eddie Murphy, you know, sort of bit.
His shtick, yeah. His Axel Foley shtick.
Exactly. But there's still this sort of mysticism regarding like this Buddhist child and the you know, the Buddhism, and he's the chosen one and all this other kind of stuff that's around it. And he kind of follows around this this other lady, Ki Nang, who is played by Charlotte Lewis. And, you know, they kind of become partners trying to find this golden child.
Yeah. And the golden child was kidnapped by this villain played by Charles Dance, who some of you will know from, well, most of you will know as one of the main villains of Game of Thrones. Right. He was also the bad guy in Last Action Hero.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in Alien 3 and a bunch of other films. I mean, he's a very, very, very British actor.
And he has just like the mean stare. He's like, you know, he's like redheaded, and he's got these like really, you know, these blue eyes that can just like look right through you. You know what I mean? And he plays an excellent sort of villain, this evil sorcerer trying to get this golden child. And it's revealed that they basically kidnap the golden child because he's going to kill the golden child so that they can, you know, the evil can take over the world or whatever.
Yeah, basically this child is the only thing keeping demons from overrunning the world.
Right.
So, yeah, he works for basically, they imply that he works for Satan.
Because he kind of turns into this, like, he kind of morphs into that Satan-y looking character.
This weird, like, demon puppet thing.
Yeah.
So
really bad CGI.
No, it's bad stop motion.
Stop motion, yeah, stop motion. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Pre CGI.
So yeah, I've got to ask you, Ryan. When's the last time you saw Golden Child?
A long time ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, maybe?
I would say the same. So I'm going to ask you very honestly.
Okay.
What did you think of it?
It's a more, I don't know. I just felt like it was, Axel Foley investigating a child. Really feel like it was just, it's just Eddie Murphy, man. It's just Eddie Murphy doing his funny shtick and kind of playing along doing the same thing.
Yeah, but dropped into like a kung fu movie, but not a good kung fu movie.
Yeah.
I'm just going to be blunt here. I was surprised. I've not seen it in probably 20 years.
Yeah.
I had very vague memories of it. And it's probably been more like 30, because I just had to think about how old I was for a second. It's probably more like 30 years. It's the whole movie's kind of a mess, man. The tone is all over the place.
Yeah.
At some points, it's really dark and kind of sinister. Other times, it's Eddie Murphy yucking it up. Other times, it's weirdly mystical and goofy.
There were times where I felt it was kind of going towards, the same thing as, Big Trouble in Little China kind of mysticism, where there's this underworld and these, spirits. And I mean, because the Golden Child can do some, like, very sort of mystical things, like, animate inanimate objects and, bring, animals and people back to life and, that sort of thing.
And it's got ancient Asian monsters of myth. But also, right? it's funny you mention Big Trouble in Little China, because it shares a lot of DNA with that film. I mean, it's got Victor Wong in it, who played X Shin in Big Trouble in Little China.
That's correct. Oh, and the other guy, too, Tommy Tong. Yeah.
Tommy Tong, who was
Peter Kwong. Peter Kwong is the actor's name, but yeah, Tommy Tong was the guy.
Yeah, he was basically Wind in Big Trouble in Little China. He was the one with the swords of the Three Storms.
Yep.
And it's also got, of course, it's got James
Hong. And I think
Hong.
He has like the same looking swords in this movie, too.
He does. He actually has the same swords from Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, I was like, wait, I think I've seen those before.
Yeah, and it even has James Hong, who is literally in, if you needed a Chinese actor in the 1980s, you got James Hong.
Right.
He was Lo Pan in Big Trouble in Little China. He was the dad in Wayne's World 2. He was everywhere in 1980s and 90s movies if you needed a Chinese actor.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, you have those three characters who were very prominent in Big Trouble in Little China, and they're all in this movie that's that goes for a very similar tone. And I have to say, after watching it, I'm really glad we didn't pair it with Big Trouble in Little China, because if we had paired them together, even though there'd be a lot of overlap, it would look even worse in comparison to Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, because I think this like played more into the sort of stereotypes of like Buddhism and things like that, like this mysticism and stuff, and that I don't really think it paid Buddhism any service whatsoever. You know what I mean? It's probably made things worse. To be quite honest, it just, I don't know. It just seems when you and I watched it when we were younger, we didn't know any better. Yeah. And, but yeah, watching it now, you're like, what?
Well, I'm going to have to compare it to Big Trouble in Little China to talk about why the Golden Child doesn't really work. Because one thing that Big Trouble in Little China does very well is it diffuses a lot of those kind of stereotypical ideas. Like every time Jack Burton, Kurt Russell's character, tries to engage in mysticism with some of the Asian characters, they always kind of respond to him in very down-to-earth, Western ways. Like, he'll try to go along with, like the philosophizing, and someone will just be like, what are you talking about?
Right.
We got to do this, or what's your problem? Or, hey, I speak English,
Right.
That kind of thing. And the Golden Child really doesn't do that. It falls way more into parody, and Big Trouble in Little China is more about deflating that parody.
Right. Well, I mean, I thought that whole scene where he tries to, buy the necklace, and then, he winds up, the guy winds up cheating him or whatever. I just thought that was so, I thought it was a little disrespectful, to be quite honest.
It really is, and I mean, I get that you have to look at these things in the time that they're made, but it was so awkward and not really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be different if it was funny, if there was some humor in it. And you're kind of meant to think that in the end that Eddie Murphy's character is the butt of the joke, but his humor really clashes with the tone of the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't jive well at all. Like his kind of like fast talking, like laughing at everything he says, kind of style, mm-hmm. does not jive with like mysticism and like epic journey.
Mm-hmm.
And all this kind of stuff.
Well,
and that's before you
go ahead.
And that's before you add in like weird stop motion monster puppets.
Well, and I think in this movie, unlike Beverly Hills Cop and Beverly Hills Cop 2 and even Beverly Hills Cop 3, he didn't really have anybody else to kind of like bounce things off of.
Exactly.
You know, he would bounce things off of Ki-Nang, which the character Ki-Nang, but she just like was straight and was like hardly said anything throughout the whole movie. So it was just like it was just really sort of awkward, you know what I mean? So I don't know.
He has no one to banter with. He has no one to banter with in the movie at all.
He's bantering and she's just like deadpan, you know?
Yeah, so and it's awkward. It's like it's like when you tell a joke and no one laughs.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what his thing is in the entire movie. He's like, he's being funny, but no one else in the movie is reacting to it whatsoever. And it really falls flat every mm-hmm. time. Literally almost every time in the film. Like, he's trying to be funny around these characters, and they just deadpan him. And the whole thing just kind of bottoms out.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no laughter, no canned laughter, no anybody reacting off of him, nobody yelling and screaming at him.
Yeah. You know what this should have been? This would have been a great time to bring Judge Reinhold back.
Yeah. Yes.
He should have been Eddie Murphy's partner in his little detective agency thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been awesome. Yeah.
He could have been the one that took everything super seriously, and Eddie's like, this is silly. See, that would have worked. And that's the other thing, man.
I mean, because even Paul Reiser, like, was somebody, you know, when he's, you know, calling his captain and everything else and or being the captain and whatever, just some funny scenes to like bounce things off of. You need other funny people, I think, to make a funny movie. And he tried to carry it sort of himself and like had nobody to sort of react off of. And I don't know if that's completely like Eddie's fault, because I'll read through the notes and I'll basically just flat out tell you that they had a much serious script, but then after the success of Beverly Hills Cop, they kind of changed some things around and they went and reshot a lot of scenes so he could do his like Axel Foley type of bit. And that's one of the reasons why this movie has this weird juxtaposition and some scenes are kind of like mixed up. So to think about it, that it's a hodgepodge, I think you really picked up on something, you know, that's really there.
Yeah, I would love to see the more serious cut of this movie, like before they reshot stuff. I bet that would be interesting. It may not be any good, but I bet you it'd be interesting.
Right. It would definitely be more, serious, more serious action film than it is like a action comedy, for sure.
Well, do you want to go ahead and jump into the trivia about this one, and then we'll double back to Buckaroo?
Let's do things backwards this time. Sure, why not? We'll do it. Since we're already talking about it.
Yeah, let's go forward.
There's a lot of notes on Buckaroo Banzai, so that makes a lot more sense. So that was my first note. It was intended as a serious adventure drama, and actually Mel Gibson was in the lead role. After Gibson turned the film down, Eddie Murphy replaced him. The script was rewritten as a partial comedy. And Eddie Murphy actually turned down a role in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, in order to make this film.
I had actually heard that before and had forgotten about that, yeah. What a weird alternate timeline that would have been with Mel Gibson and The Golden Child Eddie Murphy in Star Trek IV.
Yeah, and The Golden Child being more of a serious film, and then like Eddie Murphy being in Star Trek IV. And while promoting Coming to America in 1988... Eddie Murphy said the original script was far better than the finished product. So, like you said, like it would be great to really see it. Eddie Murphy's this was the first Eddie Murphy movie with a PG-13 rating. Because really he was only like in what, two movies really before that, like another 48 Hours, Beverly Hills Cop, and you know,
Yeah.
But the next PG-13 rating movie he was in was The Nutty Professor a decade later in 1996. So, and I was going to bring up, this is really one of the first movies that, like, this was the second movie that had, like, the run of, like, when it was released, like, debuted at number one in the box office. So, because this was 1986, Beverly Hills Cop was 1985 or 84. Hold on. Give me a moment. Talk amongst yourselves.
Doing research, killing time.
It's great Bear doing this, you know, working from or doing this from home, because then I can have a full computer, like, in front of me. You know what? I just looked up his discography, not his filmography.
well, okay. so completely so we different. Record Party all the time.
Yeah, exactly. He did three albums. No, so no, he was his first movie was 48 Hours, but when he did Beverly Hills Cop in 84, then The Golden Child, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Eddie Murphy Raw, Coming to America, Harlem Nights, another 48 Hours, Boomerang, and then the next movie that he was in 1992 is in Boomerang in 1992. And then the next movie he was in did not debut at number one. It was The Distinguished Gentleman. And then it was Beverly Hills Cop 3, The Vampire in Brooklyn, The Nutty Professor, Mulan, yeah. You know.
And he really bottomed out after Boomerang.
Yeah.
And he's made a bit of a comeback now. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah. So, moving on. George Miller was Eddie Murphy's first choice for director.
Now, George Miller is, of course, the guy behind the Mad Max series, and he also did Lorenzo's Oil and the Happy Feet films and the Babe movies. And he would have been great. He would have done a great job with the special effects. He understands, you know, weird tones. A George Miller version of this movie would probably be pretty great.
Do you know why he turned it down?
No idea.
Eddie Murphy kept him waiting at a meeting for hours.
Well, good for George, because George Miller's a master filmmaker.
I'm not waiting. I'm out of here.
Yeah, so, that's a pimp move right there. Yeah,
because it's like if you're not gonna have the respect to meet me on time and be here, if you're gonna keep me for 2 or 3 hours, like then I don't want to work with you because you know it sets a bad tone. So he was out.
Like, I made the road warrior. Damn it.
Yeah, it's like if you either want me or you don't, so I'm out. John Carpenter was offered the job as director also.
Well, we know he can make a better version of this movie for sure.
Yeah, and then, yeah, because he did Big Trouble in Little China in 1986. So as for the Golden Child itself, the Golden Child, the actor, was supposed to be a male, but in reality, she is a female. Her name is Jasmine Lauren Reet, who was seven as when filming began.
So. I did not notice that. I didn't notice that in the credits. That's interesting.
Alvin Silvestri from Back to the Future, the music. Okay, this is what I'm talking about, the music, which originally set to produce the film score but turned the project down. So John Barry, who was the composer of many Bond films, did all the music. But then after that, like it didn't test well with audiences. So they brought in this other guy, Michael Columbia, who brought in the more like synth pop kind of like sound. So I think they were going after like, you know, that Harold Faltermeyer, you know, we talked about that in Beverly Hills Cop. And it was like when they were doing the scenes, they were like, because John Barry wrote this like really serious, you know, like orchestral like thing. And it was like was jiving with the comedy. So they had to bring in like the synth pop to make it more to make it lighter. So.
And yeah, it didn't quite work. So it's the same that Silvestri couldn't have been the composer. He's a great composer. Mm-hmm. He's had a ton of great scores. Like the theme for this movie is all these really talented people ended up turning this movie down.
Right. You can hear a lot of what, because a lot of people said that John Barry, the music score was really, really great because this was one of the few non-Bond movies that he did. And in 2011, it was released on a limited edition 3 CD soundtrack containing the entirety of Barry's mostly unused score, and it also contains the other score from Columbia as well. So if you want the synth pop, you know, that's on there as well. So
sounds like an interesting curiosity for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to hear it. I almost wanted to get it because I'm like, wow, that'd be interesting. I don't know where they would be in the film, but just to hear what John Barry created, because a lot of people that heard it, a lot of people in the film industry, you know, felt really bad that he did all this recording and sounded awesome and never got used. But both Ann Wilson from Heart and Rat are on the official movie soundtrack, which was, I thought was awesome.
Yeah.
I
kind of like Rat, to be honest with you. I'll admit that here and hope no one remembers, but right. Yeah.
I just love the commercial where they have the Geico commercial. Where they
that one's been playing so much lately, yeah.
They have a rat problem. Anyway, the budget for the Golden Child was $25 million. They made back $79.8 million, which...
So it wasn't a flop. See, I had always heard it was a flop.
Well, here's the deal. I went back and looked, and... When you compare the budget of the Beverly Hills Cop movies, and I went back to my notes to see, the budget for Beverly Hills Cop was $15 million, okay? It made worldwide $316 million.
Yeah.
So when you compare 316 to 79.8, yeah. You know, or even Beverly Hills Cop 2, the budget was $20 million, and worldwide was $299 million. So when you compare... you know, $300 million to $79.8 million. You know what I mean? It's yeah. Not the big booming, like, big budget thing that they were looking for. Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars.
Wow. I don't know what to say to that. I really don't.
And here's what he had to say. I heard Paramount feared it had a bomb on its hands. But what were they worried about? The preview audience laughed all through the movie. No wonder, because this film, insignificant and lightweight and monumentally silly, is entertaining from beginning to end. Although it contains the usual scatological language, the sex and the violence are mild. So,
well, he was known to like some crap, you know.
I think
bless you, Roger, but you're not always right.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, because audiences liked it, he maybe felt that he had to, you know, get on the bandwagon. I don't know.
Sometimes if you see it with a good crowd, I mean, if you see it with a crowd who's into it, it'll give you a more positive feeling about a movie for sure.
Rotten Tomatoes critic score is 26%.
That's fair.
Audience is 47%.
That makes sense, though I know a lot of people in my life who think really highly of this movie.
Yeah, I think it's mostly nostalgia, you know. I mean, it's still kind of fun, but you know, I've seen better films from this era that are better films. Leonard Maltin's publication TV Movies gives the film a bomb rating, which is like a box office hit, but and he says it was a box office hit, but have you met anyone who actually liked it? Yeah.
Yeah, Maltin was always way more of an everyman kind of critic. He's not as good of a writer as Ebert, but yeah. But it definitely has some fun opinions.
So let's get into the notes of Buckaroo Banzai. So
let's do it.
When considering the role of Buckaroo Banzai, Richter wanted who was the writer, W.D. Richter, to remind everyone. He wanted an actor who could both look heroic, grease with grease all over his face, and project the kind of intelligence you would associate with a neurosurgeon and inventor. He really liked the performance from Peter Weller in Shoot the Moon, so that's how he kind of got the job there. Lithgow told one interviewer, "I've had roles where I came very close to going over the top. In Twilight Zone, I almost went over the top several times, but this role is completely over the top. It makes the role in Twilight Zone seem like a model of restraint." And I would agree, because he is way over the top. It was apparently there's a scene where Buckaroo is tortured by Dr. Lizardo, and Weller remembers laughing so hard at the banter between Christopher Lloyd and John Lithgow that they had to stop takes over and over because Weller was laughing so much.
They certainly are funny in the movie. Their banter is one of the better things about it.
Yeah, so if you're watching that scene, just remember it's like probably like take 47 or something like that, you know. apparently in that scene too, the electronics that you see in the background were actually taken from Frankenstein films, because I think it was like on the MGM lot or whatever.
Very cool. Very, very cool.
Alan Barkin, who played the romantic interest, Penny Pretty, P-R-I-D-D-Y, describes the film as if Terry Southern had written Star Wars.
I like that.
Yeah, Dr. Strangelove. So I had to look up, you probably know, which is why you laughed. I didn't know who Terry Southern was. But he wrote Dr. Strangelove, The Loved One, The Cincinnati Kid, The Magic Christian, and some work on Easy Rider. So and just Dr. Strangelove by itself, just that did it right there. I'm like, oh, yeah, I get it.
It's got that absurdist tone to it.
Yeah, very satirical. Jamie Lee Curtis played Buckaroo's mother in a flashback, but that scene was cut. So you can see that cut in the, I think that's, the DVD. It has those cut scenes. The original, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's a really nice special edition Blu-ray from a company called Shout Factory. Mm-hmm. If anyone out there likes the movie and doesn't own a copy, I highly recommend the Blu-ray from Shout Factory. It's a great special edition.
The original director of photography of the film was Jordan Cronwell, who famously shot Blade Runner in 1982. But the only thing that's still left that he was involved in was the nightclub scene. He was replaced by Fred Jay. So I guess there was some disagreements on the tone of how it would look. It looked a little too serious, and then they wanted it like a more flat, like looking look. So he was replaced.
I'm going to say something. I think it's a shame because the nightclub sequence, when they're performing, that's actually the best looking part of the entire movie.
It is. I know it almost like looks like it was shot with a second crew. You know what I mean? Like I know they do like A crews and B crews. It almost looks like one of those like type of deals. You know,
like it's super stylish and that makes sense that it was shot by someone else who has a completely different visual style because the rest of the movie is kind of flat looking.
Yeah, it is very flat looking, and I think it would have been, you know, way cooler done in that way.
Me too.
The film's closing scene. Oh wait, hold on. Yeah. The film's closing scene in which the characters join each other to walk, as the credits play, was shot at the I'm going to mess this up. Sepulveda Dam. I think that's correct. Adjacent to the concrete LA riverbed.
Which those have been used in a lot of Hollywood films, mm-hmm. most famously To Live and Die in L.A. You've seen them. Like, you've seen these, big concrete basins.
Terminator 2, I think.
Terminator 2, yeah.
Grease. A bunch of films. The original, okay, so... the music, but apparently the music wasn't ready, so composer Michael Boddicker told the film crew to use the song Uptown Girl by Billy Joel as a placeholder because it was the exact same tempo. Those scenes were filmed with Uptown Girl blaring from a boombox on the back of the camera truck.
You can kind of see how they would lay over that scene of them walking at the end. Yeah. And I gotta say, I love the scene of them all reunited at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, even the characters who have died who wouldn't have been part of the little posse, having them all together like that, it's such a nice way to kind of, it's kind of like a curtain call for like a theater play. Like everyone comes out and takes a bow, basically. It's such a nice, pleasant way to end a movie.
It was also parodied in a Wes Anderson movie, wasn't it?
It was Life Aquatic,
I think.
It was, yeah. The Life Aquatic, I don't know if it was an intentional parody, but there's similar... Yeah. Was it? Okay, well, yeah. It's very, very similar, yeah.
And it's been parodied in a couple different things, too, that I've seen. I mean, when I saw it, I thought it was a parody of something else, and I was like, oh, wait, okay, no. And I looked it up, I was like, no, this is the original. So Yeah, very iconic ending there, as they all, like, you know, as Banzai's walking in the middle and everybody kind of joins in from the side as the, like, the shot backs up. 20th Century Fox hired a team of publicists to promote the film at Star Trek conventions with a few film clips and free Banzai headbands, which have become highly sought after collector's items. So they were the same, like, headband that he put on, like, right before he went on his, you know, went through the mountain or whatever.
Yeah, I bet you those are really expensive now. Huh?
Yeah, I haven't looked them up. I didn't do my due research there. But Marvel Comic Books also published a comic book adaptation as a 2-issue limited series at that time. And also Moonstone Books began publishing comic books in 2006, depicting earlier and further adventures of Buckaroo Banzai and the Hong Kong Cavalier.
It's such a rich world of Buckaroo Banzai and the Hong Kong Cavaliers. I mean, like I said, they imply that they've had so many adventures that it's just ripe for, like, expanding on.
There was also, I read something else about the headband. I want to go back to the symbols are supposed to mean two different things. Like, I can't remember what they are. Anyway, I'm going to move on. Also released in 1984 to help promote the movie were games from a company called Adventure International that was available on Apple II, Atari, the 8-bit Atari, Commodore 64, Commodore Plus, Commodore 16 and Commodore 64, sorry, IBM PC compatibles in ZX Spectrum. So yeah, a lot of, like, weird PC game tie-ins. The budget for the movie was $17 million and box office, are you ready?
Yeah.
$6.3 million.
Oh, yeah. I knew it did bad, but that's really bad.
It was released August 15th, 1984, and faced competition from Star Trek III, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and Ghostbusters. So they weren't released the same week, but those were still, I mean, 1984, you know, movies was, you know, incredible. Like, I know we did the one of 1985, but 1984 was also really big.
Yeah, well, that's probably going to be a year we go back to when we decide to do one of those kind of episodes again, because a lot of great stuff came out in 84.
Yeah. Richter said, it has the most dramatic reactions of anything I've worked on. Some loathe it, and others are willing to die for it. And I would probably say that's probably true. Rotten Tomato critics score. I want to say this. It's the first time that any movie that we have watched where the critic score matches the audience score. So critics and audience score, 69%.
Nice.
There is a website, yoyodyne.com, as a fan site. And if you go to yoyodyne.com, you'll be greeted with a text that says, Yoyodyne Software Systems, Inc., a tiny little division of Yoyodyne Propulsion Systems, is a front organization for the evil red Lectroids from Planet 10 via the 8th Dimension. Any information on our hated enemy, Buckaroo Banzai, and his oscillation overthruster should be reported to John Big Boute. And then there's a link to another site, which is worldwatchonline.com, which is the actual fan site. But yeah, I thought it was fun. You need to go to that link when we get off. You need to go to yoyodyne.com. Did you know about that site?
I did, because, like I said, but the Buckaroo Banzai fan community is super passionate. So I've been off and on interested in it for quite a while.
Right. So in late 1998, the Fox Network announced the development of a Buckaroo Banzai TV series entitled Buckaroo Banzai, Ancient Secrets and New Mysteries, but was never released. So they developed it, but didn't make any episodes. And then recently in May 2016, Kevin Smith announced he would be adapting the film for television through MGM Television, and even Amazon indicated a deal was being negotiated to produce the series. However, in 2018, Kevin Smith revealed that he backed out due to MGM lawsuit against the original creators. And I also further read that because, okay, so how the original script, like, I couldn't even go over that in the notes because it was like somebody wrote it and it got passed to this person. And then, like, eventually, like, I think Paramount had it at first and then went to MGM. And so because of all these, like, hands that were sort of involved in everything, even just to release the DVD was like a, you know, paperwork, you know, a stack high to try to get all the agreements to release the DVD. So to try to do a series, then you have to have a lot of people once again sign off on all these characters and the new development, which not going to really happen.
Yeah, and it's killed a lot of projects over the years, that kind of thing. Red tape can really be a bitch.
Yeah, especially when you have so many people that have, you know, so many invested points in it. You know what I mean? So because when somebody writes a script and gets passed off to you know, like, say MGM bought it, right? And they, you know, have somebody go, okay, well, you rewrite it. Well, they become a co-writer at that point. They're a co-owner. And they kind of own, you know, co-own the character. So, and then after that, like, if they pass on it, then they can still use some of those ideas for the next thing, and to the next thing, and the next thing. And then, like, soon you have, like, 8 people who are the creators of this one movie.
So. And that's a lot of paychecks to have to cut, so.
Yeah, and that's a lot of agreements that you got to get. And some are, like, not even, they even if they're not alive, then it's, like, the estate, and they're like, no, we're not gonna do it.
It's really a shame, man, because, it, like I said, it's so rich for exploration.
Right, or like, we want this amount of money, or we want this, or we want a cut of this. Like, you created this, and it's just like, they, you know, they can't make agreements to pass it all on. So, I mean, that's why the deal with Star Wars was such a big deal, to just, you know, Lucas just handing over the keys to Disney. Here you go.
True. You don't see things like that very often. Right,
show me the money. Thanks very much. Have a good day. So, anyway, so that's it. That's all of my notes.
That leads us to our then thing we always talk about here on this show. If you were to rent these movies from the video store, and let's start with Buckaroo Banzai. If you were to rent Buckaroo Banzai from the video store, would you keep it an extra day, or would you get it back on time and avoid those late fees?
I'm gonna have to watch it again because it's just so. Even if it's just weird to just, like, understand it a little more. But, I mean, I think I really appreciated the humor. And but, yeah, like you, I want to see more of those intricate moments and things that I missed when watching it. It's definitely, yeah, once again, another movie that you can't, like, be on your phone while you're, like, watching the movie. It may not move the quickest. It may not move the quickest, but there's still, like, a lot of stuff happening that you got to pay attention to.
It's a movie that the more you sit with it, the more you kind of want to go back and visit it again.
Yeah.
It sort of worms its way into your head, and you just kind of get the urge to go back to it. That's how I feel about it. I mean, I obviously would keep it an extra day. I own a copy of it. I think it's great. I show it to anyone who I think would be remotely interested in it.
But it's kind of like watching Monty Python for the first time. Like, if you've never seen Monty Python, and you're like, you know, I remember the first time I watched, you know, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and I'm like, this is silly. But then after that, it's like one of my favorite movies. It's kind of the same kind of concept, you know? It's first kind of silly, like, what the heck? But then after that, you really appreciate all the stuff in it.
You have to kind of hone into, like, the wavelength of it. To use, like, a music analogy, it's like hearing Devo for the first time, or listening to Ween for the first time.
Right.
You don't really get it at first, but it kind of grows on you, and then you realize, hey, I like this. I'm not sure why I like it, but now I'm going to go back and try to figure out why I'm starting to like this.
Exactly.
And as you revisit it, you're like, oh, now I understand. It's like you hone in on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the first time that people heard Radiohead. They're like,
exactly.
What is this? This is just weird. I don't know. And then you're like, you listen to OK Computer for like the fifth time, and you're like, okay, you start to sing along, and you're like, okay, I get it. But yeah, it's that kind of thing for sure. I like that analogy a lot. Golden Child, I'm just gonna return. I mean, I don't care to see it again.
I hate to say it, but I didn't like it, and I'll never watch it again.
All right. Fair enough. So What would you, as a video store clerk, sir, what would you recommend to go along with these movies?
Well, to give a recommendation, I'm going to give an obvious one, but the obvious one comes with a bit of a backstory. At the end of Buckaroo Banzai, they imply there's going to be another one, and it's called Buckaroo Banzai versus the World Crime League. And that movie obviously never happened because, you know, it failed at the box office. Well, Richter, who wrote Buckaroo Banzai, and this has been disputed, but it's kind of believed that parts of that script for Buckaroo Banzai versus the World Crime League were reworked into another film that we've talked about a lot today called Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, okay.
So there's a little bit of Buckaroo Banzai's DNA.
In Jack Burton. In
Jack Burton.
Yeah, okay. I can
just
see
like
that.
Just like how there's a little bit of you know, the Golden Child and Big Trouble in Little China are kind of get some shares from the same DNA. Big Trouble in Little China is kind of the Rosetta Stone for both these movies, oddly enough. So, of course, if you're going to watch these two movies, you got to watch Big Trouble in Little China.
I agree. I you know, when we chose these movies, like, I didn't really realize how those three movies were very intertwined, and they very much are, for sure. You know, it's both, like, actors in this movie, and then like the writer for this movie for Big Trouble. And then like even to learn that like, you know, that the director of Big Trouble in Little China almost directed The Golden Child. I mean, it's just kind of like two strange connections, yeah, you know?
There's a lot of shared DNA between those right. three. So to me, they're actually always going to be intrinsically linked in my mind.
Right.
Whenever I think about them, you know.
Right. Well, I am going to recommend another movie that's going to go in a different direction. I am going to recommend Earth Girls Are Easy.
You know, that would work really well with Buckaroo Banzai. Yeah,
I think that movie is the closest movie I can ever think. When I first watched it, I'm like, because I've seen Earth Girls Are Easy. I mean, they play that like on Comedy Central, I think a couple of times, because it's, you know, one of those weird cheap comedies. I mean, it has Jeff Goldblum and
Jim Carrey, David Alan Greer.
David Alan Greer, Gina Davis. And I think Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum were still romantically linked at that time. And yeah, I mean, it's just one of those weird, like, outlandish sci-fi comedy movies that like mix the two genres together. I mean, and it's done before. I mean, you had like, you know, My Stepmother is an Alien or something like that, but that movie is just like really, you know, also just as ridiculous, I think, as some of the ridiculous scenes that I loved in Banzai with like the Lithgow and Christopher Lloyd. So,
and it's also hard to define, so it definitely goes along with it very well.
Right. And, you know, Golden Child, I don't really have a recommendation for. I still, you know, if you like Murphy, one of my other favorite Murphy films, I think, that are a forgotten movie that I think will still hold up. And we're going to do it. I promise you, I'm going to convince you to do it. We got to have a match for it. But we've done too much Murphy so far. But maybe next year. But we have to do The Distinguished Gentleman. You have to see that movie. I've never seen it.
So I would like to watch it. Yeah.
Because it's still like Eddie Murphy doing his thing, but he plays like a completely different sort of charming fellow that is not quite as foul-mouthed, you know what I mean? And he's way more charismatic, and there's just a lot of other funny, you know, actors that are in that movie as well besides just him. And I think it's one of those forgotten comedic gems from Murphy.
Well, we will certainly get to it. I have no doubt, because he's got some other films that I would like to watch again. So I'm sure we can figure out a way to pair those into a double feature in the future.
Right. All right. But that about does it. We hope that you like this episode. If you like, Buckaroo Banzai, you know, let us know. Or if you hate it, let us know.
If you hate us for not liking The Golden Child, please let us know.
Yeah. If you love The Golden Child, we're sorry. But, it's not as a woke movie as we thought it was.
Yeah. Well, and just, you know, sometimes nostalgia revisiting these things doesn't always work out, and that's part of the journey.
Yeah.
But, you know, I still had a good time this week. I look forward to doing it again in 2 weeks. Thanks for hanging out with me, Ryan.
All right. Well, thanks, Essery. This is a fun one. We'll catch you on the flippity flip.
Hey, guys, and go watch some movies. And also, remember, we don't have to be mean. Because remember, no matter where you go, there you are.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
On that, you never know what it might be attached to.
Inventor.
Activate oscillator.
He's broken the sound barrier. Philosopher.
No matter where you go, there you are.
And the only hero.
Buckaroo.
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 Curse are you, Banzai!
Who can save us all?
Evil! You are inseparable from the eighth dimension! Burn him!
Launch thermal pod.
Buckaroo Banzai is pure nutty fun.
Buckaroo, you forgot your thruster.
What are you holding on to for a while?
The cult sci-fi classic.
Run, run!
In a dimension all its own.
Real-life Martians are landing in New Jersey.
Torito, torito.
We will fire a portable beam weapon.
Vaporize the whole damn planet?
If we blow this today...
Get him up!
There ain't no tomorrow.
Left, I said left!
This is left!
I mean my left, all left, go your right!
Buckaroo, the president's calling about, is everything okay with the alien space club from Planet 10, or should we just go ahead and destroy Russia?
Tell him yes on one and no on two.
The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
Which was yes, destroy Russia or number 2?